Fists?
He shrugged.
Yeah. At any point, did you call down to Cheyenne and ask the investigators at DCI about this?
Yeah.
They seemed pretty upset that they hadn't caught it.
I had gone back to the report.
I bet they did.
Chapter 5. October 21st, 6 days earlier, afternoon. It had meant a great deal that Eric Boss had driven down from Billings just to have this conversation. I know it's a lot to ask, Walt, but you'd be doing me a big favor. We're into this one to the tune of close to $9 million. And if there's any funny business, I just want to make sure we're not the ones footing the bill. I sipped my coffee and slid it across the counter for Dorothy to refill.
What exactly is it you want me to do?
The insurance man pushed the bone-white, cattleman-style hat back on his head, and I noticed the golden crucifix hat pin that glinted in competition with Boss's grin.
Well, nothing illegal.
He shifted the smile to the chief cook and bottle washer.
How good's the pie today, honey?
She looked back at him more than just a little askance as she poured coffee.
Are you trying to get our sheriff in trouble?
Nope. He picked up his mug and winked at her from over the edge.
Just got a tough job and need a tough guy for it.
She placed the pot back on one of the burners and dumped the grounds from the other, readying it for a refill.
You get him hurt, and you're going to know what tough is.
Boss ignored her and reached down to pull up a leather satchel that was engraved with the words, Cowboys for Christ, across the hand-tooled leather. He retrieved a thick file from the bag and put the pile of papers on the counter between us.
You know me, Walt. I don't mind paying on a righteous claim, but I need to know if this one's on the level.
Don't you have investigators who do this sort of thing?
We do, and the last one I sent barely escaped with his life.
He sipped his coffee.
They are a regular bunch of outlaws out there. The law of the land has left Absalom, and I need somebody to go out and reintroduce it.
To the tune of $9 million.
Exactly.
A feast is made for laughter, and wine makes life merry, but money is the answer for everything?
I didn't see any reason to tell the insurance man about the phone call with Sandy Sandberg, or the one with Attorney General Joe Meyer, for that matter, figuring there was nothing like getting offers for more marching orders on a march you'd already decided to make.
Ecclesiastes 10:18.
I slid the folder beside my mug and looked up at the blond man's nonplussed face.
Who's the beneficiary in all this?
It took an instant for Boss to respond.
Barsad's got a brother in Youngstown, Ohio, who sounded on the phone like he was just as glad to hear Wade was there.
He hasn't shown up?
Nope, but I don't think there was any love lost between them.
What did he say about the wife, Mary?
He thought about it. Didn't say anything.
No questions about why she did it or how?
Boss shook his head.
Doesn't that strike you as odd?
Some, but they sounded estranged, so maybe he never met the wife.
Vic swung open the door of the busy bee and sat on the stool beside me. Boss glanced at me and then at Vic.
Hello, young lady.
I continued to study the file without looking up.
It's all right, she's with me.
Taking his chances, Boss ordered the pumpkin chiffon pie and looked back at Vic.
We were just discussing that people do all kinds of horrible things to each other, young lady, but I figure that's between them and God. I'm more concerned with the work at hand.
From the corner of my eye, I could see Vic nodding. Amen. I flipped to the contact sheet. There were a couple of numbers for Wade's brother, work, home, and a cell.
You mind if I give him a call?
Be my guest.
I read the figures and tallied up.
So you think he burned all those horses with the intention of insurance fraud?
I don't know, but I'd say it was pretty telling of his character if he did so.
I flipped some pages. The problem being DCI didn't find any signs of arson. The insurance man grinned in Vic's direction, the effect being halfway between a snake oil salesman and a snake. He watched her closely as Dorothy poured her a cup of coffee. She doctored it with the requisite cream and four sugars.
Exactly. You want whipped cream on that pie?
He was still looking at Vic when he answered, "Yes, ma'am, that would be fine." I followed the insurance man's eyes and then gazed up to the crucifix on his hat. Maybe your boss was trying to hit him with a lightning bolt and missed. His face colored a little, embarrassed at getting caught staring at my deputy.
My boss doesn't damn well mess.
He leaned forward and tipped the brim of his hat to Vic.
Excuse my French, young lady.
The coffee cup had stalled out just in front of her lips.
Yeah, well, you watch your fucking mouth.
October 28th, 12:48 a.m. I lay there listening to the loud voices and country music and thought about how much energy it was going to take to put my clothes on, go next door to room number 3, and tell them to turn it down and quiet up. There wasn't a lot of space with the two of us on the bed, but the beast had insisted. He was sprawled across the bottom, so I'd attempted sleep with my feet hanging off the edge diagonally. It didn't work, so I made use of the only reading material I could find in the room. I stuck an index finger in the Bible I'd found in the bedside drawer, left for travelers in need of salvation via the Gideons. Absalom was seemingly prime territory. There was a loud thump against the wall, and Dog sat up at the end of the bed, a low growl beginning to emit from his pulled-back lips. Easy, easy. I took a deep breath and rolled my head over so that I could see the partially melted clock radio's plutonium-like green numbers. 12:52 a.m. The headache was still lingering, and I started thinking that I should have gotten some of Mary Barsad's medication myself. The party in the next room had started a little after midnight, and an hour later, the soiree was in full swing. I retrieved my index finger, stared at 2 Samuel, and read aloud. And unto David were sons born in Hebron, and his firstborn was Amnon of Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second Kileab of Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite, and the third Absalom the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. I paused and looked at Dog's big brown eyes. Are you getting all this? His head lowered back to the stained bed cover. That's a lot of begetting. I skipped ahead to the juicy part. Absalom was riding upon his mule, and the mule went under the branches of a great oak, and his hair caught fast in the branches, and he was left hanging between heaven and earth. I nudged the beast with my foot, but he ignored me. That's what you get for riding a mule. I continued my theatrics, and Joab thrust 3 darts into the heart of Absalom while he hung, still alive, in the oak tree. And 10 young men, Joab's armor-bearers, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him, as if the 3 darts hadn't done the job. I nudged Dog again, but he didn't move. Seems like all they do is beget and slaughter people in this book, in the Old Testament part, at least. The volume of the radio next door increased. It was a station out of Durant, and I recognized Steve Lawrence's voice as he introduced the next song. This is an oldie but a goodie, Cattle Call from that Tennessee plowboy Mr. Eddie Arnold. I remembered that it had been one of my mother's favorites. A fellow by the name of Tex Owens had written it while waiting to do a radio broadcast. It had begun snowing in Kansas City that night, slowly at first, but then it had blotted out his view of the buildings across the street. 1:05 a.m. Owens had grown up on a ranch, not unlike myself, and had done a lot of cattle feeding in the winter, knew what it was like for the animals out in the weather, the wet and cold. He'd felt sympathy for all those animals and just wished he could call them all in and break up a little corn for them to eat. 1:06 a.m. 30 minutes later, he had written the music and 4 verses. I could still see the little 45 turning on my mother's suitcase of a record player on hot afternoons in August.
I was in high school and thought the tune one of the corniest things I'd ever heard, referring to it as goat yodeling music. My mother knew I hated the song, and so she played it constantly. She might have been the reason that I was considered by some as a bit of a wise guy. 1:07 a.m. I found my lips moving along with the lyrics. I'm not a very good singer. As a matter of documentation, I'm horrible, but I can be loud. My father used to call it my field voice and forbade me to use it in the house. As I started singing, Dog turned and looked at me with an ear cocked. In the short time we'd known each other, he'd never heard me sing. Encouraged by his attention, I sang louder. Then I sang even louder. I'm pretty sure I was shaking the walls when Dog joined in.
Ooh, doodle-dee-dee, oh, de-odle-odle-lady. 4 hours he'd ride on the range far and wide. When the night winds blow up a storm, his heart is a feather in all kinds of weather when he sings his cattle call. Ooh, doodle-dee-dee, oh, de-odle-odle-lady.
I gave out with one more chorus of yodeling, and Dog howled with me when I noticed that they had turned the radio off next door. There was a certain amount of conversation, and I could hear a number of expletives as somebody thrashed around the adjoining room. He was cursing and threatening as a woman laughed. Then she laughed again. 5 seconds later, the somebody was hammering my door. Dog barked and arrested the Bible on the nightstand, got up and slipped on my jeans and boots. I ignored the .45 Colt in my duffel and opened the door.
You some kind of fucking comedian?
As I'd suspected, it was Cliff Cly. I guess he had decided to take his party to a room. He was still wearing the same droopy potato chip straw hat, sunglasses, and the 2-day beard, but had stripped down to a sleeveless T-shirt that read Pro Bull Riding Tour. He was holding a bottle of Jack Daniels and leaning a shoulder on my door jamb for support. Dog growled from behind me, and I turned my head to shush him, then turned back to the ranch hand. "Excuse me." He leaned in a little closer, and with the strength of the alcohol fumes, I was sure I didn't have any hair left in my nose.
"I said, you some kind of comedian?"
I studied his face, the wobbling intent of his eyes, the elongated nose. "I don't take myself all that seriously, if that's what you mean." He cocked his head and tried to focus his eyes on mine, and I could see just how profoundly drunk he was.
"You," he belched, "you take me seriously?"
"Right now, not so much." He stood there for a moment more, then pushed off from the doorway. He staggered a second and started to raise the bottle, but the movement was so slow and clumsy, I didn't even bother to raise a hand in defense. Instead, I watched as he lost his balance.
"Aw, shit!"
I reached out and tried to grab him, but I was too slow, and he sprawled backward and landed on his back with a liquid thump, the bottle of whiskey skittering down the slight gravel incline toward my rental car. I took a step forward and crouched down on the walkway as Dog trotted out and joined me in looking down at the semi-unconscious Cliff Cly. I glanced back at Dog. "I know this is twice in one night, but people don't usually act like this." Dog looked at me, unsure if I was telling the truth or just defending the species. I gathered Cliff, sitting him up and leaning him against my shoulder. "Are you all right?" His hat fell off. His head leaned against me with sunglasses askew, and he belched again.
"I'm kind of fucked up in general, so it's hard to gauge."
I had to smile. "Well, let's try and get you into your room." He was heavy, and I could tell that the majority of his weight was muscle, but I was able to put one of his arms around my neck and lift him to a partially standing posture by grabbing his belt, which was made out of some kind of chrome timing chain. The door to his room was still open and the lights were on, so I moved us in that direction.
Dog sniffed at him, but then moved away. He definitely didn't smell good. When I got to the doorway, I recognized the Rubenesque tattooed woman from the bar. She was seated on the bed in a bra and panties, and she looked to be about 4 months pregnant, a fact that had been hidden by clothes earlier. Her mouth, which was outlined with very dark lipstick, made a perfect O. "Can you help me with him?" She looked past me with black penciled eyes. "Where's the jack?" I carried Clyde toward the bed and sprawled him there, face first at her feet. "I'm just guessing, but I think he's had enough." She got off the bed and walked past me toward the door. There was a peacock on her back with feathers that exploded in greens and blues toward her neck.
"Yeah, but I haven't even got started."
I rolled Cliff over and figured he could sleep it off where he lay when I heard a yip come from the young woman. I turned and saw the dog standing in the open doorway had frozen her. I walked over, shooed dog with my leg, and led her through the door. He looked hurt and considered us like a disgruntled Grendel.
"Where's the bottle?"
Before I could catch myself, I glanced toward the car and down the slight incline. She looked up at me, her blonde hair shifting to the left. I think the dark roots were a fashion statement.
"You're the guy from the bar."
I reached for my hat, but then remembered it was sitting on the table in my room. "Yes, ma'am."
"Do I know you from somewhere?"
"I don't think so."
"You look real familiar."
I couldn't place the face, and it was unlikely I'd forget the tattoos, so it was possible that I hadn't ever arrested her. "Guess I've just got one of those faces." She smirked in an attempt at a smile.
"It's a good face."
"Thanks. It's a little tired right now, so I'm going to take it to bed." She walked down the incline, tiptoeing on the gravel with bare feet, stooped, and picked up the bottle, and crow-hopped back to the wooden walkway. She held the whiskey and her stomach with her left hand. The other she stuck out. It had a locomotive amid floral designs and a jack-o'-lantern, which trailed up her arm in blues, purples, yellows, and reds.
"Name is Rose."
"By any other name." I stood there for a second, then extended my hand into hers. Her grip was strong.
"Did you hit him?"
"No, he passed out."
"There wasn't any fight part?"
"No, the passed out part came before the fight part could get started."
She shook her head. "That's Cliff all over. These rodeo cowboys all think that 8 seconds is a good ride."
She raised her other hand, which had a lace-like design inked on the fingers that became snakes that intertwined as they climbed.
"Most people wouldn't stand up to him like that."
"Seems like you were rooting for a fight just a couple of hours ago." She smiled fully this time.
"Boring night in the big town. I was just looking for a little excitement."
She glanced into the room she shared with Cliff and then looked back to me.
"He's only been around for a couple of weeks, but I can tell you, he's crazy."
I nodded. "I'll remember that."
"You strike me as one of those guys who doesn't forget much."
I watched as she brought the bottle up and noticed there was a good 2 inches left. I thought about a young woman I knew, an Indian princess, who had been born with fetal alcohol syndrome. "How about you not do that?" She paused.
"What?"
"Just do me a favor and don't drink." "For the next 5 months, I thought. But you've got to start somewhere."
"Why?"
"You're pregnant." She looked down at her belly in mock surprise.
"Wow! Wonder how that happened."
There's a bone-weary quality to putting on your white suit in these kinds of situations, but you do it anyway. "What's your baby's name?" Her hand dropped to support the girth as she grinned.
"Wiggle."
This was going to be harder than I thought. She tossed a shoulder and then leaned it against the T-111 siding of the motel's exterior wall, closed her arms around herself, and shivered.
"It's what it does."
I stood there looking at her and said nothing. I had probably said too much already.
I reached a hand out for the bottle, but she pulled it behind her, and a look of anticipated defiance streaked its way across her face.
"Hey, no way!"
I took a deep breath and marveled at my ability to find a place even more tired than the place I'd been.
"Okay."
I turned and started into my own room.
"What do you mean, okay?"
I looked back at her and then gestured to the front of the R. "If I take that away from you, what's to say that you won't just go back over to the R and get a full one?" She studied me for a while, an even more puzzled look on her face.
"The what?"
I shook my head, just to clear it a little and make sure I was the only one in there. "The bar." Her head cocked to one side, and the blonde page boy swayed just a little as her eyes stayed steady with mine. I stood there for a moment as she turned and began closing the door behind her with her foot. The bottle was still in one hand, and her belly was supported with the other, where worlds collide.
"Mr. Good Samaritan, you're in the wrong town."
The door shut softly. Boy, howdy. I stood there thinking about Wiggle, about what kind of chance he or she had, and wondered, in a place like Absalom, what kind of chance any of us had. I was about to go back to my room when I noticed that the truck parked in front of the R was a new red Dodge Dually with no plates. I motioned for Dog to go in and then plucked my shirt off the chair. "Stay, and this time I mean it." He looked after me as I closed the door. I circled the back side of the empty truck and couldn't see any temporary tags taped to the inside of the back window that I might have missed. It was probably some young rancher having made his first, second, or third pile of money from coal bed methane, or one of the local boys coming back to show off a little to the hometown crowd of 40. There were a million reasons for the truck to have been there, another million for it not to have plates. I wasn't sure why I was fixating on the Dodge, other than the oldest trick in the lawman's repertoire, the hunch. I walked the rest of the way around the truck and paused at the passenger door. It was locked, but on close inspection, through the tinted windows, I could see a Winchester lever-action 30-30 propped up against the dash. I looked back at the bar. The lights were out in the main room, but it looked like there were still a few on in the kitchen and back. I thought I could hear voices and decided to circle and see who might be inside. I walked to the right and went around the final unit and up a small rise to the roadway behind the motel. There were no streetlights in Absalom, and along with a smear of clouds, it was a moonless night that made it hard to pick through the high grass, garbage cans, and automobile parts without making a racket. I finally found a path that led to the back of the establishment's kitchen. There was one light on in the short hallway connecting the bar with the kitchen, and it looked like there were two men talking. They edged a little closer and could make out Pat's profile beside a payphone on the wall. He was leaning back with his arms folded as a taller man in the shadows gesticulated passionately. They were keeping their voices low, but it was a heated conversation, and I could just make out the gist of the thing. The owner of the bar lifted his head and looked at the other man defiantly. Neither of them said anything for a few moments, and then the taller man began speaking again in an even lower tone with his index finger in Pat's face. There was a mud room leading into the kitchen, and I carefully opened the screen door and slipped inside, or slipped as gracefully as I could. The floorboards bleated and complained under my weight. I stood there without moving, but the conversation stopped. I waited for a moment and then leaned forward to get a better look. But the light was off now, and both men were gone. I pulled back into the corner and stayed where I was, waiting for the next sound, which was the pump action of the shotgun I had seen on the shelf under the bar. I could run, but I don't do that very well. I could waltz through as if I were just looking for a little midnight snack and get a serving of a few ounces of lead for my trouble, or I could just stand there quietly like a buffalo in a stand of year-old aspens, pretending that if I can't see them, they can't see me. I heard footsteps in the bar. whoever it was, either Pat or the tall man, they weren't playing fair. The first thing we always tell people who have to deal with burglary is to make your presence known by flipping on all the lights, scream at your wife to call 911, and turn loose the dogs while you get the .38 from the closet. Never, but never go sneaking around in your own house at odds with some stranger. Nobody was talking. Nobody was turning on lights. And I had that hunch feeling that nobody was calling 911. There was some more whispering, and I could hear someone coming down the hallway through the kitchen and toward the mudroom where I stood. He was moving slowly and carefully. I could see the barrel of the shotgun first and could even register the diameter 20 gauge in the direct cast of the moon that had, of course, chosen to come from behind the clouds. If the thing shifted 4 inches to the left, it would be pointed directly at my guts. The shooter stepped forward, and I could make out the hands holding the scattergun and the gold Masonic ring. The owner of the bar and maker of the crapper laws stepped full into the moon glow, blinked, and looked out the screen door to my right. The barrel wavered for a second, at which point he took 2 steps closer, still looking out the doorway and into the overgrown back of the place. I could see his face clearly. His hat was missing, and it looked like there was some swelling around the nearest eye. Blood was palmed from his nose to his hairline. I looked at his hand again and could see the still wet blood there. Evidently, the taller man had struck him. I hadn't breathed since he'd entered the tiny mudroom, and still didn't. I watched him lean his face forward to get a better view of the back bushes. The swelling at his eye certainly wasn't helping in the search, but he must have seen something because he suddenly turned toward me and looked directly up to my face. The sound was already coming out of his mouth when I grabbed the shotgun with both hands and pivoted the butt up and into his chin. It sounded like a cleanly hit baseball. After a brief moment of teetering, he started to go over backward, but I was now practiced and grabbed one of the straps of his overalls and pulled his collapsing body into me. I lowered him to the floor with one arm and leaned him against the wall with his legs folded underneath him and then checked his pulse, which was rapid, but there. Out cold. I wondered why he hadn't fired. I checked the Winchester and discovered that the reason he hadn't was that he must have automatically clicked the safety on, something a lot of inexperienced shooters do. I was happy with his inexperience, clicked off the safety, and stood. More footsteps echoed from the silence, and I took the 2 steps that would give me a clearer view of the short hallway leading toward the front of the building. I could only see a small portion of the bar. Nothing. I unfocused my eyes to adapt to the dark and allowed them to become motion sensors as I stepped into the kitchen proper. There were a few BLTs on 2 plates on the cutting board, along with a couple of cans of Coors. One of the sandwiches had a single bite taken out of it, and the other had been eaten except for the crusts. Evidently business had interrupted dinner, and then there was me. The floor continued to complain under my weight as I took the 1st step into the hallway. I kept my eyes on the surface of the bar, fully expecting someone to flip over the counter with a 2-handed grip and pop a few into my chest. I raised the pump action to my shoulder and tried to remember which way the front door of the bar opened, settling on left to right, and chose the right and larger side of the public room on which to concentrate. Television and movies would have you believe that the proper way to do this type of thing is to leap into a room, first directing your weapon one way and then the other, but without backup, it's a 50-50 proposition that you'd enter said room dead. In the dark, if you're alone, the rule is reveal low and very slow. I crouched at counter level, slid along the wall, and scanned the area where the makeshift fight ring stood ghostly and empty. I pivoted the shotgun to my left, keeping it level to the bar, and looking into the area where there were the few tables and mismatched chairs. Still nothing. I was sure I hadn't heard the front door open, and equally sure that the other man must still be inside when the big Dodge chirped and the interior lights came on in the truck. I started around the bar, quickly moving toward the front, when something moved to my left, raised up, and fired. I staggered back, tripped over a loose chair, fell to the floor, and scrambled to put the bar between us. His aim had been high. He stood and continued forward around the bar and toward me with what sounded like a 9mm. The rounds from the semi-automatic blew through the beer poster on the wall and tore into the ceiling as I found the baseboard and turned the 20-gauge back toward the shooter. I decided to shoot high as well, since all I really wanted to do was back him off long enough to get a look at him. I pulled the trigger and listened to the loud crash as the front window of the bar exploded onto the walkway out front, immediately followed by the roar of the Dodge as its engine dieseled to life. I abandoned the thought of a remote starter and figured he'd just been throwing down cover fire long enough to get himself out the door to his avenue of retreat. I struggled up from the floor and grabbed the corner of the bar as I ran toward the jagged glass shards of the now shattered front window. I slid to a stop in the full illumination of the truck's high beams. I brought the Winchester up in a half extension, the barrel pointed directly at the darkened driver's side. Old habits die hard, and the words were out of my mouth before I could reassess. "Sheriff, freeze!" There was a brief second when absolutely nothing happened, except the second, third, fourth, and fifth helping of guessing. You don't know who they are. You don't know if they're going to comply. You don't know if they're still armed. You don't know if they're still aiming at you. You don't know if they're involved with the case, and you don't want to shoot even after being shot at unless you absolutely must. Then the big full-ton shifted, and the reverse lights illuminated the rear of the truck. I lowered the barrel of the shotgun, aimed at the radiator, and pulled the trigger. There was a sharp click. Nothing. I jacked the pump action as the Dodge flew into reverse, sprayed gravel in a murdersome arc, and was jammed into a forward gear. I took aim at the rear tires and pulled the trigger again. Click. Nothing. The truck disappeared over the hill at the edge of town and then reappeared on the next hill, hell-bent for diesel leather as it continued down the Powder River Road, the smoldering running lights like tracers in the darkness.